Hey, welcome aboard. This is John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me one more time. Let me get this out right up front. This is a two-part Life 2.0 podcast. This is two episodes. I've never done this before. I am pretty adept at editing and extracting and slicing and dicing and cutting corners here and add a couple corners over there and doing the things that need to be done to kind of bring these episodes between 50 and 59 minutes, somewhere there. I am really well aware of the fact that our ability to sit and listen to long-form information is basically extinct. However, because I'm a stegosaurus myself, I decided that when I do these shows, and it's what I've always done on radio, that I think that conversation can lead to transformation with a measured dose of inspiration. And when I come across a conversation like I had a couple weeks ago with a couple of gentlemen that you're going to hear from in just a few minutes, I could not slice and dice it like I normally would in a conversation. So number one, that's that part. The second part is, rare is it that I have two people on at the same time. It's very difficult, a lot of moving parts, so you have two voices plus mine. And I hate that in baseball and in football when they do the announcing. It's like you got to fill every second with something that needs to be said because they're getting paid to talk. In this particular case, it's all worth it in my humble opinion. So this is two episodes. Rare is it? Listen, I've gotten paid very well to talk most of my life. So when I'm at a loss for words, that should be an indicator to you that it is worth your time to listen to both of these episodes because I think there's some serious treasure to be found amidst a lot of rubble one of the gentlemen in particular has gone through. But before we get to all that, the conversation itself aside, I can't help but thinking I'm stuck on this concept of synchronicity. Carl Jung actually is the guy who coined the term. He said that's when events become meaningful coincidences. They occur with no seeming casual relationship, yet seem to be meaningfully related. So I know we've all had these things like you think of somebody and the phone rings, or you're thinking of somebody and you're walking somewhere in the store or whatever and you run into them. Meaningful coincidences that they don't seem to be connected, but somewhere they have to be. And I don't know where that somewhere is, and I don't know that we have much control over that except putting out our intention. This podcast should not exist. You're going to hear more about that down the road here as this conversation unfolds. But suffice to say that there is no physical explanation as to how an email I sent to one guy named Dan Millman came back a couple days later from his office to two people that I don't even know, and my email address is nowhere to be found on that. So to me, I could do one of two things. I could ignore it, or I could follow it. Is it an accident, or is it an incident? I believe that it's an incident. So this is one of the times I get a chance to talk to someone who has had more difficulty, more challenges, and more back up against the wall experiences than I pretty much think anybody I've ever met. And he has remained humble through all this. He has remained teachable through all this. And he's become a messenger because of this. And so this is episode one, Life 2.0. And I also get a chance to kind of, the best part of this, I mean, they're all great parts of it. And the synchronicity stuff aside, I spent 4 years in the United States Coast Guard in aviation at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago, and I just loved it. I mean, this is back when I was 21, 22 years old, and to be around the helicopters and to be in the helicopters and fly in the helicopters, and one time I actually got a chance to fly it. But, you know, now the statute of limitations are run out, and I wasn't a pilot, so we'll just leave that where it is. Don't tell anybody. The guy who let me fly is probably listening, so there's that. But I got a chance to be around a very specialized group of men and women who not only are about search and rescue, but they're also about teamwork and building relationships and making a serious difference in the world. And every time Veterans Day rolls around, Armed Forces Day, the United States Coast Guard's been around since 1790. And I'm not going to get into the whole story of how I ended up there instead of the Marines, because that's where I went to the recruiting office. The Marines, they were out to lunch. The Coast Guard guy's like, here, sign this. Okay, I'm in. I was the wannabe Marine who became a Coast Guardsman, and I'm very, 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 very proud of that. And both gentlemen in this show today, as you will hear, also share that background. Episode 1. Enjoy. Paul Langlois graduated from the United States Coast Guard Academy, New London, Connecticut, class of 1976. He retired as a United States Coast Guard captain. The President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Distinguished Flying Cross to Commander Paul A. Langlois, United States Coast Guard, for extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight on the night of 12 February 1997, while serving as aircraft commander of Coast Guard HH-65A helicopter 6589. The aircrew was engaged in the perilous rescue of two people from the sailing vessel Gale Runner that had become dismasted, disabled, and was taking on water in a gale south of the Kiliot River off the Washington coast. Commander Langlois flew the helicopter more than 85 miles on instruments, aided only by radar and his co-pilot's night vision goggles, below low cloud ceilings, heavy rain, 40 to 50 knot winds, and occasional turbulence. While en route to the distress vessel, Commander Langlois was diverted to search for a Coast Guard motor lifeboat also dispatched to assist the Gale Runner that had become unreported and was believed to be in distress as well. After a brief search for the missing lifeboat, Commander Langlois was directed to rescue the persons aboard the Gale Runner, now in imminent danger of going on the rocks in the sea stacks forming the Kiliot Needles. Commander Langlois navigated the helicopter between the sea stacks and located the vessel, being battered in heavy surf and gale force winds. Unable to safely use the helicopter's hover augmentation system over the 25-foot seas, and with no visual clues, he attempted to lower a rescue basket to the vessel's crew but was unable to safely do so. With the vessel now being swept towards the sea stacks, Commander Langlois repositioned the helicopter further downwind as the Gale Runner was dashed on and then between the rocks. With the vessel now in relative lee of the sea stacks, Commander Langlois twice positioned the helicopter over the heaving and rolling sailboat to safely hoist the victims. Relieved of his search duties by other Coast Guard helicopters, Commander Langlois landed the helicopter at Station Kiliot River and then directed the search efforts for the missing motor lifeboat crew. Commander Langlois' actions, aeronautical skill, and valor were instrumental in the rescue of two people. His courage, judgment, and devotion to duty are most heartily commended and are keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Coast Guard.
From Aztec shore to Arctic zone to Europe and Far East, the flag is carried by our ships in times of war and peace. And never have we struck it yet in spite of foeman's might, who cheered our crews and cheered again for showing how to fight. So here's the Coast Guard marching song. We sing on land or sea, through surf and storm and howling gale, high shall our purpose be. Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame and glory too. To fight, to save or fight and die, aye, Coast Guard, we are for you.
This is one of these podcasts that I dread and can't wait for at the same time. And let me just get to the dread part first. Most of the guests that I have on this show are either in the studio with me right in front of me where I can control everything that goes on technically. And if that's not the case, they're on the phone, one of them, and that's not so bad. But today I have two gentlemen on two different lines going through my 19, never mind what year, Samsung phone with a bunch of wires and stuff all reconnected. I literally took out black tape here for a reason. I got the wire taped to the phone just to make sure that the jack stays in and doesn't pop out while we're having this conversation. So all the technical stuff is kind of sitting here with spit and Kleenex. And on the other side of this, the thing that I'm really looking forward to is this is a podcast. It's a conversation, really, that is on some level really probably shouldn't even be taking place. But it is, I may call this episode beyond belief because it is beyond belief how this has all transpired. Let me just set the stage for you a little bit before I bring Cliff Bayouk in. Dan Millman is a best-selling author. He's a world-renowned teacher on human consciousness. He's a world-class athlete. I've known Dan Millman since I got in radio in 97 and 1998. He was one of my first guests. I read his book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, fascinated by it. Honored to have him on the show 6, 8, 10 times over 20 years. So earlier this summer, I sent an email to Dan, who I've not heard from in years, because I came across a cassette tape of his of a show we did in 1999. So 20 years ago. And, oh, I got to get a hold of Dan Millman. I didn't even know if Dan Millman was still around, but I found him. I sent an email a couple days later. Sure enough, I get a response back from Dan. John, great to hear from you. Where you been? It's only been 20 years, whatever it's been. And we went back and forth on some things, and he has a new book coming out. He said, hey, when I finish the book, why don't I come on then? And sure, no problem. All great. Wonderful. That was it. And the next day, I somehow get another email, not from Dan, but from someone in his office, an assistant or somebody that's working the you know electronics end of things, or maybe his webmaster. I'm not really sure. And it's an email, but my email address is nowhere on this email that I got. My personal email address is nowhere on there. And it was from this woman in Dan's office and to Cliff Bayouk. And I, who's this woman? Who's Cliff Bayouk? And why am I getting his email? So I let it sit for a day or two in my email inbox. And then I decided, you know, let me just open it before I dump it because I was getting ready to let go. And I look at it, and I just took a brief glance. You know, you get a lot of emails. You don't want to mess around with it and just let it go. And on the bottom, it says something to the effect. I should have pulled it up, but something to the effect that just remind Dan that I'm the Coast Guard guy or something. And I thought, what? I'm the Coast Guard guy. Who's this guy? So I sent an email back and responded to both of them. And a few days later, I got another email back from Cliff, and it was just astonishing that there was literally no reason on the physical plane that I should be getting this email, much less what are the odds that this guy was in the Coast Guard. Now, I was in from 1980 to 84, and then I did 2 years in the reserves in aviation, Coast Guard Air Station Chicago and a couple other places. I'd go out on TAD and do my thing and come back. It was a great time. Didn't make a career out of it, but I'm so proud of the time that I spent in the Coast Guard and what I learned there and the crew. It was all great. And then we start talking and come to find out that, yeah, he was in and he was in prior service as well. And one thing led to another. And so that's the setup on how this podcast that you're listening to all over the world actually came to be. Something else is going on here. And I've had a couple people say, so what are you going to talk about in this podcast? I'm like, I don't have any idea. I mean, I kind of know where we're going, but this shouldn't even be happening. So before I go any further, I want to bring Cliff on and welcome him from Media Pennsylvania. Cliff, here we are, my friend.
It's great to be here, John. And let me just first of all say thank you for your service.
Well, right back at you.
Yeah. I'm just grateful to be here. And just to add on to your story, when I got the email back from you on your signature line, it said the word media.
Yeah,
I thought the media was in the signature piece. And something inside me just jumped out at me, and I thought, wow, this guy's a Coast Guardsman. I think you even said you're an aviator in your email back to me.
In aviation, yep.
Yep. And I thought of Paul right away. And because I've been thinking months and months and months, years actually, of how the how to get Paul's story out there.
Yeah,
so I think it's such an amazing story.
Right, so just hold that thought a second. Just confirm for me that there really is no feasible way to explain how that email took place. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right. It's just totally, this is beyond our, you know, our control, for sure. Yeah.
And as you were starting to talk to me about Paul's journey, I thought, now there's three of us here. So what's really going on? Because usually when three people in the Coast Guard get together, it's not to talk about this kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying? So let me just preface this. I mean, I am so honored to have this gentleman on. I've been almost beyond words because we've had a couple conversations before prior to this podcast. I've done more research and digging on this incredible guy. Not a lot of people I know have the Distinguished Flying Cross. So Captain Paul Langlois joins us on the Life 2.0 podcast. Welcome on board, sir.
Well, thank you, John, for having me and Cliff as well for bringing us all three of us together. And I look forward to discussing my past and my current story, and we'll see where it goes. But great being on your podcast. I've never done a event like this, and so I'm a little bit apprehensive, but I think things will work out great as we move forward.
Wait a minute, Captain. You have the Distinguished Flying Cross. You've had a heart transplant. You're apprehensive about doing a podcast? We all have our lines of comfortable where we're at, right? So, Cliff, tell me a little bit about how you two met, and then we'll let Paul get into his kind of his history here.
So I met Captain Langlois. He was my boss back in 2004, I believe. I was the head of the Coast Guard's Disability Evaluation System, part of the Coast Guard Personnel Command. And Paul had taken over as command there, and just an amazing gentleman, aviator. I'm a surface guy myself, or a deck watch officer, as they say in the Coast Guard. So deck watch officers won't admit this, but they're always jealous of aviators. But we always say there's more planes in the world than there's ships in the air. So there you go. Anyway, but Paul helped me transform the Coast Guard's Disability Evaluation System. And that system is in place to properly find out if an active duty member who's sick or injured can continue their service. And if they're not able to continue their service, then the service is obligated to compensate them in some way. And Paul and I transformed that system. Paul was so supportive of me during that journey. It was an amazing journey. We had a lot of visibility from the highest level of the Coast Guard, and matter of fact, outside of the Coast Guard, because our efforts actually were an impetus for the greater services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, to transform their systems as well. So it's ironic sort of that Paul, what's happened about Paul in the time that he left there and today. And it's so, there's so many connections here for me, but, so I've known him. He was my boss, and then he's become this great friend, and he shared his journey with me and many, many people that he's gone through, which we'll hear about here. But he, from the time I knew him, back then, you know, this guy's a super athlete. He would ride his bike from places in Stafford, Virginia, which is a good 50, 60 miles south of Arlington where we work. He'd ride his bike to work and back every day. He was just like this amazing human being, who was a personable as anyone you ever want to meet. Great leader, knew how to get things done, and just set the example. And so anyway, and it's been wonderful to maintain our friendship and our connection, and with his wife as well, his wife Linda, another great Paul and Linda, by the way, just so you know.
Nice. And,
so, that's pretty much it. Mm-hmm. I've known him as first as my supervisor. And then I was up at the academy, by the way. This was a few years ago. He was a class of 76. And he was there, I think it was near Reunion, if I'm not mistaken, Paul. But I forget why I was there. But I was adopted into class of 76. Even though I didn't go to the Coast Guard Academy, I taught there for a number of years. But I really feel very connected to Paul in many ways. So. Mm-hmm.
After that introduction came, you and I talked, we had a couple emails, then we talked again, and I said, well, you know, what is it that I'm supposed to do to help here? I mean, because I really don't know, and we went back and forth about, well, maybe it's just allowing people to hear Paul's story so they look at their lives differently. There's probably 1,000 hidden treasures in this conversation that everybody will take away in their own way, in their own time. But before I even got on the phone with Paul for the very first time. Go ahead.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah, go ahead. It's your show. Go ahead. Interrupt. Go ahead.
So, John, one of the things that I really, the pointy end of the spear here, if you will, for me, was the fact that you guys are Coast Guard aviators. And that's a brotherhood sister. That's a close group that has a lot of connection, and there's a lot of life-saving, there's a lot of heroism. And to me, I really wanted to see what would happen when we get a couple of Coast Guard aviators in the room together.
And we had that phone call. and I was just going to kind of go to that. So after we talked initially the first time, I called some guys that I thought might know Captain Langlois. And the first guy I called was my lieutenant back at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago, which was Rusty Muncy. And we had a great talk about Paul, and he's like, yeah, he's a real deal. He's like from Mayberry, Rusty. Yeah, he's a real deal. And then I sent a note over to Gary Butler, and Chief Butler knew your name. I sent a Facebook message to Steve Ziemek, who was a lieutenant at Coast Guard Air Station Chicago. He was in the Coast Guard Academy in a class ahead of you. And as your name, and I think the one, Paul, and we'll jump right over to you in a second, is the one that touched me the most was someone who you reminded me of, even though I've never met you in person. And that was our common friend and crewmate, Rod Leland, the late, great Rod Leland. And he was an incredible athlete. And so when we got on the phone, probably the first 15 minutes was old home week. Yeah, I know that guy, and I know this guy, and you knew this guy. And I think that kind of laid a groundwork for us. So let's kind of just pick it up from there. And, you know, I know you were even apprehensive about doing the phone call, but I think the shared background to some degree that Cliff points out kind of helped both of us.
Okay, John. when you asked me to tell my story, I'm not quite sure where I should start because there's so many ins and outs of my life. But I think what our interest is not so much all the sea stories and air stories and great people that I was fortunate enough to interact with and work with in the Coast Guard active duty time, but probably what everybody seems to be talking about lately is my second life, if you will, after my diagnosis of a rare disease, a blood disease called amyloidosis. Most people have not heard of it. But about 5 to 6 years after I retired in 2006, my whole health situation took a turn for the worse. I had been, as mentioned before, a very active racing cyclist, if you will, for many years, about 30 years, actually. I raced bikes at the national level. And I mention that because I was very in tune with my body and you know, how my heart worked and my health and my fitness. And so in about a one-year span, I went from winning at the national level in masters track racing to barely able to walk up a flight of stairs without being breathless. But interestingly, it took about 6 months after that for my doctors to figure out what was wrong with me. And it started when my mother-in-law, of all people, was visiting Christmas Day, and I was complaining about my symptoms of swollen legs and being out of breath and almost fainting when I stand up. And she says, oh, you have congestive heart failure, just like a lot of my friends do. I mean, almost, you know, jokingly saying, you know, casually, if you will, that, oh, yeah, you have congestive. So I kind of freaked out. And the next day, my wife Linda's prompting, went to the local ER. And I had been to my primary care provider, and they just wrote off my condition as, oh, Paul, you're just getting old. And I knew that was not it. I knew there was something else going on because I looked normal. But this cardiologist at the ER was smart enough to do some heart tests, you know, the typical EKG, echo, chest x-ray, and he did some lab work, and within an hour he came back, looked me in the face in the ER and said, I've got congestive heart failure, not just a little bit. I have a very enlarged heart, and your lab work is looking really interesting, and he kind of left it at that. He called me back to his clinic 2 days later and said, I believe you have a very rare disease called amyloidosis. And, of course, I had never heard of that word. I had no idea what it was. And he told me, don't go home and look on the internet because you're going to get scared.
Hmm.
And, of course, the first thing I did when I got home was look on the internet. And all the forums and all the information said it was a rare disease, there's no cure, and the average lifespan is 6 months.
Whoa.
And so things got a little bit interesting. I went back to the doctor a week later, and he set me up for a test that would tell me whether I really had the disease or not, and that's a heart biopsy, which at the time for me sounded like big-time surgery, but in reality, now that I've had 23 heart biopsies in the last 9 years, it's really not a big deal. But it came back positive, and I learned that I have the disease, and so I immediately wondered, well, how am I going to treat it? He said there was no cure. I had a bone marrow biopsy a few hours later at an oncology clinic in town, and they tested me and I guess the word is the type of amyloid in my body. And fortunately, the oncologist said, I know the head of Stanford's oncology and cardiology department, and I'm going to call them if you don't mind, because they just set up a new program for managing amyloidosis among two or three other clinics in the U.S. In other words, back then, there were very few clinics that even knew what they were doing with this disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led to me going to Stanford, which is about 100 miles from my house up here in Santa Rosa, California. And to this day, I probably made, I guess, 150 trips back and forth to Stanford Hospital and their healthcare system down there in Palo Alto. But my first meeting at Stanford was with the head of their cardiology department, who also was the director of the amyloid center. He looked at my records from the hospital that I had been seeing up in Santa Rosa where I live, and he looked me in the eye with Linda next to me and said, "You've got 2 months to live, unless you get a heart transplant." And so that led to about 3 hours of discussion in his office and explaining everything that was probably going to have to go on to keep me alive. And we accepted the fact that I needed a heart transplant. And so we went through about 6 weeks of pre-qualification measures to rule out any other disease in my body, which would have disqualified me from a heart transplant. I had a surgery to have a ICD pacemaker defibrillator installed to keep me alive until the heart transplant. And with great joy and luck, maybe from heaven, within 6 weeks after I was, within 6 days after I was listed for heart transplant by Stanford, I received a heart.
It was a great day
for me.
6 days.
Oh. And so that was almost 8.5 years ago when that happened, just to put it in perspective. And
Paul, this is Cliff.
If you or Cliff would like to interject a little bit.
I think Cliff's chomping at the bit.
Feel free to break me off. I'll take a glass of water while I'm talking.
Go ahead. Yeah. Cliff, go ahead.
I did find the original email that I sent you, John, back in July.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that really is amazing about Paul is that I think we can all tell by just listening to him, he's very matter of fact about this.
Yes.
And he tells the story as if he's also observing what's happening. And so one of the things he didn't mention just now is that when he sent out an email to everyone months and months after he was, past the surgery, the heart transplant, and that happened to happen, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, on Easter Sunday. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That, to me, is a special maybe symbolic day for me, but, you know, spiritual in nature. But yes, it did happen on Easter.
Yeah. So, anyway, didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted that was a, to me, that seemed a factoid to bring out.
Right, and I also think, because I've only heard bits and pieces of this, that you did get this heart transplant, but Cliff, you were telling me that there's some interesting kind of metaphysical connections here with the young, it was a 15-year-old's heart that you got, isn't that right?
Well, I could tell that part of the story. In the world of organ donation, when someone receives a organ, you're not entitled to automatically learn who the donor is or who the family is from that person. But after a period of, in my case, 6 months, through the social worker network in a regional manner beyond the hospital, I did seek to learn who my organ donor was. And I wrote a letter, which was from me, but to an anonymous address, but the social worker community sent it to the family. And I did not know if I'd ever receive an answer. But about a half a year later, which was 1 year after my organ transplant, I got a letter in the mail. And I opened it. It was from the family of the donor. Hmm. And I learned that it was a 15-year-old teenager in high school, and they explained that I didn't learn too much then, but I learned more later through my ability to email and call them. They allowed me to interact. They opened up their life to me, and I learned that they lived in Redding, California. I'm not going to give you their name, but
well, sure.
But it was a very nice family. They had two sons, and the older one, his name was Austin, was walking home from school with two of his friends, and they were crossing a street with a curve on it, and it was a state highway, and I guess there was not a crosswalk, but they used the same route every day to walk home, and he was the last one to cross, apparently, and we don't know how he looked back and forth, but he ended up being hit by a truck. And I'm in a state of vegetable state, basically brain dead. His mom kept him alive, I guess, with the doctors for 4 days. And finally she released him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's a difficult thing to talk sure about, but for me, it was a great gift, and I received his heart. And for at least 10 other people that I don't know who they are, they received other organs from his body. And I learned when I met them, and I arranged a meeting with my wife and my son, Nathan, who joined us to meet their family. And they told us that the mother told me that about 1 week before his death, that Austin had a little discussion with mom and said that when I was at DMV getting my learner's permit for my license, I decided I wanted to be an organ donor, and I checked the block, and I wanted to tell you, mom, that that's what I did, and I feel that that's just something I need to do. And they had a discussion, and she understood that he had made that decision 1 week prior to his death. And so if he had not done that, I perhaps may not be talking to you right now. But I guess that's a little segue into
sure
that, well, part of the story.
What I wanted to say at that point was, you know, there's much like this conversation that really is on some level beyond description. The fact that you were diagnosed with this condition, told you need a heart transplant, 6 days only. That's, I don't know what the average wait time is, but I'm sure it's not 6 days, Cap. That's that part. And then the fact that this young man had the wherewithal, and I've, you know, I've talked about this on the podcast and on radio for years. It's in the books that I've done. I donated a kidney to my daughter when she was 13 years old. And that's something that I would think a parent, if they had the ability to do, would it be a no-brainer. But for a 15-year-old boy to just get his permit and then make that decision and then tell his mother that these are my wishes, and then a week later, those wishes sadly have to come true. I mean, I know at some point you said this in so many words that you got to kind of look back at this timeline and go, wow, this is just really, really incredible. And I'm sure that there's been a lot of lessons for you that's come out of that over time.
So, John, this is Cliff again. To close the metaphysical loop, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, but the younger surviving brother of Austin, his name was Nathan, is Nathan, your son's name.
Yeah, that's true. And my Nathan and his Nathan really hit it off when they met, and it was kind of a special day we spent with them. And I thought that was interesting, I guess, that connection was there too. So it's still a special bond we have with the family. We don't see them. I have not seen them more than that one visit, but I have pretty much annual and sometimes off annual emails with the mother who communicates with me by email. She believes Austin is still somewhat living within my soul, if you will. And I tell others, not her, but I don't think that's the case, but she believes it, and I'm fine with that. And so if that's true, his presence is still in me. And he was quite a young man, I learned, because he was almost like the most popular kid in his class, because I know that because when I was there, they had about 15 of his classmates come by the house just to meet me.
You're kidding.
And interact with me and see who I was, and that really made them happy. I mean, it really lifted them up, and of course it lifted me up too. But he had a cheering section in his high school. He was one of those, you know, very social, everybody knew him, you know, all-star kind of kids. And so that was a special time when we met the family. Mm.
After the transplant, I mean, you were sort of an upper-level cyclist and athlete anyway. As far as, you know, any problems with organ rejection or anything like that, were you able to kind of get back to in time, back on the bike and do the things you used to do?
Yeah, I wanted to try to get back cycling as soon as possible, as soon as I was really strong enough to. And, of course, the first thing I was able to do was walk. And one thing that really surprised me is, although I had to wear a mask for about 2 to 3 months everywhere I went for a possible infection, lung infection, and other things that are in the air, but only 6 weeks after my heart transplant, there's a nearby walking trail, and I ended up walking 5 miles, and I don't usually walk more than 1 mile. I mean, I used to ride my bike a lot, but I couldn't believe it. So I knew I was on my way to being able to have some sort of ability to exercise again.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long thereafter when I was able to go home. I had to live near the hospital for almost 3 months. They don't let you go home. They're constantly bringing you back to the clinics for checkups and lab work and various things and heart biopsies. And they're very, very worried about organ rejection in the first year, particularly in the first 3 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not have any symptoms of organ rejection, to answer your question. And so finally, when I got home, the first thing I did is grab my bike and head out and start doing some mileage, gently at first. And one thing that's interesting about organ transplant, the heart, is the adrenaline mechanism, which is through a nerve between your brain and the heart, is basically been severed. It's a flight or fight response mechanism. So when you start exercising, your heart does not respond rapidly. In other words, the heart rate stays low.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're trying to go faster and faster, but your heartbeat is not responding. And it takes about 15 to 20 minutes just to get it up to an average rate for moderate exercise, whereas a normal human could probably do that in 1 to 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens after you stop exercising at a moderate level. Your heartbeat keeps beating at that same pace, and it doesn't start relaxing for sometimes 10 to 15 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of an interesting thing if you're trying to be an athlete, managing your heart. And so it's a difficult thing to take place. It also doesn't go to the highest heart rate that you had previously. It tends to stay at a much median range throughout, both higher at the resting and lower at the maximum. And so I had to learn how to manage that heart rate to do my exercise. But interestingly, as the years have gone by, it seems like that nerve process has sort of gone back to almost normal.
Really?
And so I guess they call it a renervation, or, you know, it's like the nerve, even though it's been severed, something in the system allows it to start to respond almost normal again, at least in my case, not everybody. So that's an interesting phenomenon that I saw happen for me. So. As the years went by, I did start to ride quite a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't compete. I did enter a couple of senior races just on a whim, and I actually finished them. But I can tell you that was so difficult for me to try to compete against people that were healthy with a transplanted heart. But I wanted to do it anyway. But mostly I did it for health reasons and for happiness,
mm-hmm.
and emotional well-being to try to, you know, do something again and get back to normal.
And so what we'd like to say, it all's well that ends well, but unfortunately, and you would never know, as Cliff points out by the sound of your voice, that anything has come along that has changed all that. But in fact, that is the case, isn't it?
Yeah, quite a few things took place between, you know, my being released from Stanford after the heart transplant and today, health-wise. Significant things happened. The first thing to point out is after I got the heart transplant, in no way, shape, or form was I cured of the disease. That was just to keep me alive. Amyloidosis was still alive and well in my body. And basically, so people understand the disease briefly, amyloids are, in my case, were abnormal proteins in my blood that were in high concentration, much higher than normal healthy people. And my body, for some reason, was not able to clear them and eliminate them quick enough so that they congregated in my bloodstream. And in my case, they infiltrated into the tissue of my heart and damaged it to the point where it was almost dysfunctional before my heart transplant. And not only can it get into the heart, my disease was called AL, systemic cardiac amyloidosis. It's kind of a long word for,
mm-hmm.
I have amyloidosis through my whole system, but it affected my heart first. Now, it can affect all the organs, and typically people have kidney damage first. You know, they can have other organs fail as well. The gold standard or first treatment that typically they want to give to people with a disease is stem cell transplant, which is a very difficult process, which basically almost kills you. They try to eliminate through your bone marrow and the production of the stem cell with the new blood cells that contain the amyloid and just wipe it out through extensive chemotherapy. And I went through a stem cell transplant 6 months after the heart transplant. And unfortunately, that did not help me, but it was a very difficult process. I was in the hospital in isolation for 1 month, and I had to live at Stanford for another month afterwards. it was a very painful and as close to death as I could describe feeling to go through a stem cell transplant. Before that, I began chemotherapy on various drugs to try to start reducing that free light chain or amyloid in my blood, and that was not much fun either. After the stem cell transplant, I had to immediately start other chemotherapy treatments, which lasted 5 years. During that time, I went in and out of different treatments. None of them worked. And other peripheral problems started to pop up with my system. On an elective nature, I had a total knee replacement from past sports injuries, which kind of complicated matters because I needed a revision surgery because the first one didn't work out so good. Of course, each time that landed me in the hospital. After the revision surgery, all the while of getting chemo after the surgery, I ended up having a very bad case of pneumonia, which put me in the hospital for a month. Three months after that, I had another outbreak of shingles, which was all over my body, and that put me in isolation for 2 weeks in the hospital until it cleared. That was all within 1 year after the two knee surgeries. I figured that was probably the end of all my problems, but unfortunately I was wrong. 6 months after that, I had some abdominal problems, and after 2 days, I complained to Linda, and she said, we need to get to the emergency room, which I went on a weekend that we were hoping to have some gatherings at my home. And it was Saturday night, and after 1 hour, they diagnosed me with a ruptured spleen. And I ended up having an emergency splenectomy the next morning, which was also Easter Sunday, and basically saved my life. I ended up having 11 units of blood transfused into me. I was bleeding out inside and didn't even know it.
Wow.
A few weeks later, the pathologist report came back and said it was loaded with amyloid. And so that organ was gone. And I had a great difficulty actually surviving that surgery. I was in the ICU for 8 days, and it was touch and go, but I managed to get through that process and finally go back home. I was convinced at that point that was the end of the problems. Although my kidneys were affected by these events, and they had deteriorated from what was several years of stage 3 failure into stage 4. And for those who don't know about kidney disease, there's 5 levels of deterioration. And after my heart transplant, I did not have kidney deterioration until about a year. And it slipped into stage 2, which is not really a difficult thing to deal with, but it's something you have to watch. A few years later, it went to stage 3, and I was hoping to keep it there.
Mm-hmm.
It did stay for about 4 years at that level. And after the episodes I just mentioned, it had slipped to stage 4. And now we were getting a little bit more concerned about my kidneys. And so my nephrologist at Stanford was seeing me at that point about every 2 months to manage my chemistry and my nutrition and any medications that would need to be administered to prevent further damage. But I could still ride my bike and exercise, and I was still being treated for amyloidosis by my oncology department at Stanford. And fortunately, a new drug came out. I had been in clinical trials for about 3 years after, and they were all various forms of chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
But I had given up on whatever drugs were available because they were not working. And so a new drug was just approved by the FDA, and it was for multiple myeloma. And so my disease was sort of an orphan type disease that they just called it a rare disease, and there were not any approved drugs for it. So we typically were given drugs for multiple myeloma, which is a cancer, but amyloidosis is not a cancer. And so my doctor said that she would think she thinks she could qualify me to be given this drug, because in order to be qualified, you have to have failed at least three chemotherapies. Well, I had failed at least five chemos and two clinical trials. So she said, I'll get you qualified, so let's try it out. So here I go again, trying another experimental drug. And I'll be darned, after one treatment, it put me into remission. Essentially, my amyloid went down to normal. And I thought it was a false reading from the labs. And the next week, I had another treatment at another lab. And the same reason, I mean, it was a miracle. I said, oh, my goodness, I'm going into remission. So I continued taking this drug for about a half a year. And the lab works continued to show that I was in remission. I was the first patient in the U.S. to be given this drug with amyloidosis. And I know it felt like a miracle to me. I was very excited about the whole situation. I felt much better, and things were going in my favor. I knew I still had the kidney to worry about, but perhaps it would stay at stage four. And meanwhile, I felt way better. I mean, I was out riding my bike now with friends and my teammates again, going up to 3 hours and starting to go pretty fast. I was thinking about racing again. Now, this was about 3 years ago. I was out riding with Linda, and one day we were about 2.5 hours into our ride, and suddenly I felt it was a warm day. I felt very cold, and I felt very lightheaded, and I stopped the bike. We're about 3 miles away from finishing, and said, man, I feel really weak, and like, I'm freezing. I don't know what's happening. And so she didn't want me to keep riding, but I insisted because I'm a stubborn guy. And we rode back to the car where we parked and rode home. And I got home. I remember getting out of the car. I immediately vomited into the bushes at my driveway. And at that point, I don't remember anything. I mean, I basically blacked out. She says I was responding normal until the next morning, but I don't remember any of it. The next morning, we were having breakfast, and she said she handed me a glass, and I dropped it on the floor, and orange juice all over the place, and I don't remember anything. And so she, of course, got very nervous at that point. She called 911. The ambulance came and got me, brought me to the local emergency room, the same place who saved my life twice earlier. They basically said I'm in septic shock. I was unconscious. My blood pressure was very, very low. And the doctor came out after I was in there for about an hour and told my wife that they could not recover me, that I was going to die, and it was too late. And she screamed at them and told them, you've got to do something. And you have to save him. He's a strong guy. Please do whatever you can.
I've had a couple of times in my life where when I was electrocuted when I was 19 years old and my heart stopped and I was brought back to life basically by a guy who was a Marine, had been in Vietnam, and was the pharmacist at the store that I worked at, and basically got my heart started again when maybe it shouldn't have. And I'm very much in debt to him. I don't know whatever happened to Mike, but I hope it's all good things. And then I was in a very severe car accident when I was 27, and same kind of deal, and hit broadside by a drunk driver and had to be cut out of the car and no pulse and the whole drill. After a couple of those things, those are wake-up calls to me. Paul Langlois is way past, this is a whole nother level of, how do I serve humanity through my difficulty? So coming up in the next podcast, you'll hear the second half of this this conversation with Paul and Cliff. I'll tell you what, it is humbling for me to sit back and listen to what this gentleman's going through right now. And then you take that in perspective of what's going on in the world. If you have your health, you have your wealth. You can click on the second episode to hear the rest of this Life 2.0 podcast.